Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
Good afternoon. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the show, and as we like to do on Fridays, we'll cover a variety of Iowa news stories of the week. In a few minutes, we'll discuss an elections proposal being considered at the State House that would prevent students at Iowa's public universities from voting early on campus. And later this hour, we'll get an update on severe flooding in western Iowa, and we'll dig into U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's family leave proposal announced this week. But first, let's check in with the Gazette's politics and government reporter, James Lynch, about some of the top headlines from the state capitol this week. Hi, James.
Hi, Emily.
Thanks for joining me today. So you've actually commented on this first story I want to talk about on our show before. Republicans in the Iowa Senate passed the controversial bill that would change the makeup of Iowa's judicial nominating commissions that recommend potential judges to the governor. Remind us exactly what this bill would change and what support it has among parties in the Senate and House.
Well, this is a priority for Republicans in both the House and the Senate, and the Senate has passed the bill. They took the House language, which scaled back the proposal. So the process for nominating judges for district courts will remain the same as it is now, with the Bar Association electing or naming half of the people on that commission to nominate judges for the governor to appoint. The big change, and this is really where opposition is focused now, is on how judges to the Court of Appeals and justices to the state Supreme Court would be nominated. And the Bar Association involvement would be scaled back, and instead minority and majority leaders from the legislature would make would select people to serve on the nominating commission. The president nominating process has been in place for since the 1960s when voters approved it. And Republicans are saying that it's not transparent enough because the Bar Association has an outsized role in selecting judges and the nominees that ultimately the governor appoints. And so they are arguing that by having legislative leaders appoint people to the nominating commission, there's more transparency and more accountability since the legislative leaders are elected by the people rather than by fellow lawyers. And it's a priority for both parties, so it's likely to win passage before the session is over.
And do we know how the governor will the governor sign
she
it?
She likes it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she likes it. She's endorsed it on numerous occasions. So, yeah, I don't think there's any question that she'll sign it.
Mm-hmm. Lawmakers approved a resolution that would give voters the opportunity to amend our state constitution, adding in language for the right to keep and bear arms. What was debate like on this resolution this week?
Well, it sounded very familiar because the legislature has debated this a couple times before. The constitutional amendment process, of course, has to be approved by two consecutive general assemblies, and they did that, and then because of a snafu in the Secretary of State's office, the legal notification didn't get published, so they're back to square one. So the House passed this the other day, and now it'll go to the Senate. Both chambers have passed it. So now in 2 years, if the legislature passes it again, it'll go to the voters. The debate was Matt Winschittle, Representative Matt Winschittle, who sponsored this amendment, the resolution said, is a simple question, do you like freedom? The response to that was, yeah, people like freedom. They also like safety. They like background checks for gun purchases. They like, a variety of gun safety measures. A major sticking point for many of the people who opposed it, and even some people who in the end voted for the resolution, is the language in the amendment that calls for strict scrutiny by courts of any challenge to gun rights. And a number of people said that's a the bar is too high. Strict scrutiny shouldn't be applied. That's the case in only three other states. And they said it's not appropriate to, you know, tell judges they have to apply this higher judicial standard to challenges to gun rights law.
Mm-hmm. We have only about a minute left, but I'm curious for this next story. A couple months after a federal judge overturned Iowa's agriculture production facility fraud law, it's commonly known as the Ag Gag Law, Iowa lawmakers have approved similar legislation. What is different or similar about this new proposal?
Lawmakers say they've scaled it back, narrowed it down so that they believe that it doesn't create a free speech issue. It's modeled on an Idaho law that has been upheld in court, so they feel more confident that this will withstand legal challenges. And it talks about if you use deceit and you have the intent to do physical or economic harm to a farm or agricultural production facility, then you would be in violation of this law. There's still a lot of opposition to this. You know, the ACLU, for example, says it does restrict free speech. And so there are a number of groups who are saying that it will be challenged in court perhaps as soon as it takes effect. And so look for more legal challenges on that front.
All right. James Lynch of the Gazette. Sorry to cut you off, James. We got to move fast and furious these topics. You can follow James' reporting on Twitter at James Q. Lynch. James is with the Gazette. James, thanks so much for talking with me.
You bet. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Another Iowa State House proposal we're keeping an eye on this week, a wide-ranging bill regarding state election laws. Among other things, it would prevent students at Iowa's public universities from voting early on campus. Earlier today, I spoke with the University of Iowa College of Republicans chair, Kyle Apple, and here's what he had to say about the section of the bill specifically relating to early voting on campus.
So my main concern with that provision is that it puts students at public schools at a disadvantage relative to students at private schools or community colleges. Just because students go to a public school, I don't think they should be punished by not being allowed to vote on their campus, while students at these other schools can still vote right where they go to class. So if this bill is going to move forward, that is the area where I would like to see it changed. I'd like to see uniformity for all students across the state. If students at public schools are not allowed to vote on campus, I just don't think it's fair that other students are. So I'd like to see that policy made the same for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, would you prefer to see no restrictions for any universities and colleges in the state of Iowa, or would you rather none of them have the opportunity to vote early on campus?
So I do think all students who are eligible voters in the state of Iowa definitely deserve to be able to vote from their campus address. I know we spend at a minimum 9 months of the year here. For me, it's in Iowa City. But wherever we go to school, we spend about 8 or 9 months in that community per year. So I think definitely every student should and does have the right to vote from their campus address. I'm not quite sure as to what the rationale behind restricting students from voting on campus is. I know the one reasoning being that some counties have more state-owned buildings than others. I'd like to see a further reasoning behind the bill developed before I fully supported something like this, because I do think that we should be making it easy for students to vote on campus. In addition to, obviously, there's plenty of ways for students to vote off campus. There's local satellite offices, there's county auditor's offices. I personally vote absentee ballot by mail. And that, no matter what happens with this bill, will still be an option for students to vote in their campus communities.
In a few minutes, I'm going to talk with a political analyst from the University of Northern Iowa who will share some numbers relating to voter turnout and early voting at UNI. I'm wondering, at the University of Iowa, how important of a resource is early voting to you and your colleagues?
So like I said, I personally vote absentee ballot by mail. I'm not personally familiar with the numbers regarding how many students use the early voting locations on campus, but I would say that I'm generally aware that the early voting locations on campus are pretty busy. I know that I've seen some pictures online. I've heard from some of my friends that say that when they go to the main library and it's an early voting day, there's a lot more people there than usual. So again, just before anything like this is actually made law, I would like to see more of a reasoning behind it developed so that way we can understand the motives behind it. I don't think it's meant to be discriminatory. I think that's just kind of the reputation that it's gaining because there's not as much information out there as a lot of people would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Last week, this plan was approved by the Senate State Government Committee on a party line vote with Republican support. I'm curious, do you feel there's a discrepancy between conservatives of different generations on this?
I just think that with students having so much exposure on campus, we kind of know what's going on. There is probably a bit of a generational divide just because the younger students on campus are definitely more leaning towards increasing voting access, increasing voting rights. And even though there's a big divide on, you know, who should be able to vote from the Republican standpoint or Democratic standpoint, I think generally all students at universities realize that it's important to get students engaged in the civic process. Everybody wants students to vote. Just because they might not vote your way doesn't mean that we want to restrict them from voting. And I don't think that that's the target of this bill at all. I really don't think it's meant to discriminate and suppress votes on campus. But I would just like to, you know, see something put in place with this bill so that whether it's, you know, you can't vote in state-owned buildings except for universities, some sort of caveat so that we can get students engaged in government. As long as they're eligible voters, we should be making it as easy as possible for them to vote without compromising the integrity of the election process.
You've said that there are parts of the bill you like. Briefly, if you would, could you take us through those?
Yeah, so probably my favorite part of the bill is the sore loser law that this bill would implement. I think that with what we saw last year in the midterm elections, it's needed. It's a shame, but I do think it is needed. And along with that, there's a provision that would, the way I see it, simplify the signature requirements for the petitions to get on the ballots. And I think that those two policies together will really help simplify the primary election process and make everything a little more fair for the candidates that are putting their name into the election. I worked on a campaign in the midterms, and I just, seeing firsthand some of the sore loser behavior from candidates that were unsuccessful for whether it be petition reasons, losing a primary. I think that the sore loser law and petition reform is definitely a good part of the bill.
University of Iowa College Republicans Chair Kyle Apple. Kyle, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
We're discussing an Iowa bill that would prevent satellite voting locations from being set up in any state-owned building. So early voting on campus would not be an option for students under this bill. Joining me now from our Ames studio with another student perspective on this is Taylor Blair, a junior at Iowa State and president of the ISU College Democrats. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. So do you feel like you and your Democratic colleagues in student government are on the same page as Kyle, we just heard, as the Republican students that you work with there at ISU?
Well, I agree with him that we should be able to vote here, and I'm glad he feels the same way. I do disagree, though, that this is not discriminating. I think it's very clear that they're trying to stop students from voting, and I think that's really shameful and undemocratic.
At Iowa State, it looks like in 2018, 1,900 people voted early. I think that's students and community members, faculty. In a presidential election year, 2016, 3,140 people voted early. Why do you feel early voting is an important resource for college students?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great that we have the opportunity, you know, everybody, you know, across the state. But specifically students, you know, we're juggling classes, we're juggling you know, work, we're finishing our homework in the evenings, and just being able to stop into the union, you know, over your lunch break is so helpful. And it's really utilized. You know, in 2014, only 684 people voted. And so that almost tripled for the 2018 general election. So that shows that this is not something that is, you know, just frivolous. It's something that people are using, even, you know, using even more than they used to. So to get rid of it makes no sense to me.
Election campaigns often reference early voting in their Get Out the Vote efforts. If this bill is signed into law, how might this change the dynamic between, you know, student orgs and political campaigns?
Yeah, well, we, like the College Democrats, and when we're working with a campaign, a huge focus for us is getting people out to early vote. We spend, you know, either the 10 days or 5 days, depending on the election, just, you know, talking to students, getting them out to the polls on campus. And if that were gone, we would have to focus all of our energy only on election day, you know, which means less students would get a, you know, direct contact from a campaign. And I think that makes us, our democracy less strong if we're not talking to voters and, you know, having those conversations.
Mm-hmm. How will your group, the Iowa State College Democrats, be engaged in this issue moving forward?
Well, we've been reaching out to our representatives down at the Capitol building and talking to people, you know, like media like yourself. And we're going to be writing some op-eds and releasing statements and stuff because this is something that makes no sense and will really hurt students.
Mm-hmm. Taylor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Taylor Blair is a junior at Iowa State and president of the Iowa State University College Democrats. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a wide-ranging bill regarding state election laws. Other provisions of this bill, if signed into law, it would shorten the time that polling places are open on election day, would require absentee ballots to be delivered by the time the polls close, and would require a county's property tax information to be included on the ballot for bond measures. As we've been discussing, it would also prevent students at public universities from voting early on campus. I'd like to get the perspective next of political analyst Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. He's a department head and professor of political science at UNI. He joins us regularly for Politics Day, and he's in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Emily.
So you emailed us recently, the talk shows, saying that UNI has some of the highest voter turnout rates in the entire country. Can you describe this as it relates to recent elections?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. We, in 2016, 67.5% of UNI students voted in the election. And as far as we know, and there are organizations that track these things, as far as we know, that's the second highest turnout among college campuses in the country. And we got recognition for that kind, those kind of high participation numbers. Last summer, we sat down with student leaders. We invited the students from the College Democrats and Republicans, other political organizations on campus, and our student government organization. And two students in particular, Matt Johnson and Brenna Wolf, really took the lead in this, what we called the Panthers Vote Initiative. And they set goals of how much we'd like to increase turnout in the 2018 election. And we don't have the full numbers in yet in terms of, you know, matching up all our students to the voter rolls. But we do know what the turnout was in the two precincts closer to campus, closest to campus, rather. And in one of those precincts, turnout was 43.94%, and the other was 49.44%. Those are extraordinarily high turnout numbers for a midterm election. So we had this concerted effort on campus. Brenna and Matt really planned things, took charge. One of my colleagues in the political science department, Justin Holmes, sort of helped organize things and provide support for them. But lots of registration, voter registration on campus, voter education series so that students were more comfortable with issues. And satellite voting was a key component of that. Nearly 1,000 people voted in early voting on campus in 2018.
So do you see early voting as kind of particularly popular among younger voters?
I think it's convenient. Some of the scholars who write about these things talk about convenience voting generally. So absentee ballots, early voting, and so all of these things make people more likely to vote. The United States, we make voting more complicated than most industrialized democracies do. But we've made strides in Iowa recently to make it less complicated. Same-day registration, for example. Voter ID has made it a little more complicated, but there are ways for students to demonstrate their their current residents, for example, and still do same-day registration. So we've made a lot of good strides in the United States to make voting more convenient, and we are seeing higher levels of turnout in the last several elections. And that might not be the only reason for higher turnout levels, but it's almost certainly a contributing factor.
Mm-hmm. And of course, students can make the effort to vote in a different way. But, you know, if this bill was signed into law, do you see it impacting voter turnout at places like you and I?
Yeah, sure. I would expect it to. And I'll stress that, you know, it's not only students who vote early. This law would harm not only students, it would also harm community members. Every time I've voted early, and I frequently take advantage of the convenience to cast my vote early on campus, and every time I've done so, I've seen members of the community who don't work at UNI, don't come to class, aren't students here. I've seen them casting their votes, bumped into them there. So it is a convenient location for students and faculty and staff, of course, but it's also a convenient location for other community members.
This plan was approved with Republican support by the Senate State Government Committee on a party line vote last week. And the Des Moines Register has noted that at least at the University of Iowa, those who voted on campus in the last two elections tended to be overwhelmingly Democratic. Do you think the political makeup of Iowa's university students has any impact, or is this simply coincidence?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I haven't seen any comments by the sponsors of the bill, other than the odd one about some counties not having as much state-owned property. That seems like a very odd rationale. What I can tell you is that this is not the only place in the country this is happening. And every place it's happening, it's being sponsored by Republicans. So in Florida, for example, the Republican Secretary of State tried to ban early voting on campuses. That was overturned by a federal court last year. In New Hampshire, the Republican-led legislature recently passed a law that would restrict college students from registering to vote. In Texas, with their voter ID law, you can provide a gun permit as a valid form of ID, but not a student ID. And so these are all different laws that have been passed in Republican-led states that suggest that they are trying to make it a little bit harder, in some cases a lot harder, for young people to vote, especially college students.
Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Peters is a professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes, and we'll be talking about severe flooding in western Iowa. We'll also get details of U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's family leave proposal. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. Right now, we're in the middle of this year's Iowa legislative session. And at this moment, the Senate seat for District 30 is unusually vacant. Democratic Senator Jeff Danielson announced his resignation last month, and the special election to fill the open seat will take place next Tuesday. District 30 includes parts of Hudson, Cedar Falls, and Waterloo. The candidates vying for the seat are Democrat Eric Giddens and Republican Walt Rogers. We'll hear from Giddens in a few minutes, but first, Walt Rogers is from Waterloo. He served as a member of the Iowa House representing District 60 from 2011 to 2019 and was Assistant Majority Leader in the House. He joins me now. Hi, Walt.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. So you challenged Senator Danielson for this seat in 2008, but you lost by 22 votes. You then went on to serve in the Iowa House, but lost that seat last November to Dave Williams. What keeps you bringing back to this work?
Well, I think I just want to serve. After the loss last November, spent some time, you know, with my family trying to decide which direction we were going to go, and then Eventually, I was offered a position by the governor in Des Moines as the chair of the Public Employment Relations Board. And so actually I was doing that down in Des Moines and excited about it and that opportunity to serve Iowans in that capacity. And so we were moving right along quite well and then heard that Senator Danielson had decided to resign. And at that point, my wife and I were just kind of at that, you know, really wanted to just stay out of it. But over that weekend after Jeff resigned, just got a lot of input from people all over the state and my district and said, Walt, you really should look at this. And it'd be an opportunity for obviously Republicans to flip the district. And I've got good name ID in the area. So after hearing all that encouragement and input from people, we decided to enter into the race.
If elected into this seat, presumably you'll jump right into the role of representing District 30 in the Iowa Senate. Is there a proposal being considered this session that you're particularly interested in voting on?
Well, like I've told people, I think it's just very important to have, you know, strong representation in Des Moines from this area. You know, as we look over the landscape of all of Iowa, there isn't too many Republicans representing the districts that have the universities, Iowa, ISU, and UNI. And so I've been actually pretty proud of my record the past 8 years of supporting education and supporting UNI. And actually, I touted a lot. You know, UNI's funding increased 28% over that time frame where I've been in there. And that is compared to Iowa and ISU at 2 and 3%. So, and I think that's directly responsible for, you know, me being in the Republican majority caucus, being able to cheerlead for UNI and tell people the different type of school that it is. And so, you know, most of the kids at UNI are Iowa students and most of them stay in Iowa. And UNI doesn't have the reserve funds that Iowa and ISU have. And so any type of a cut or decrease in their funding was really a big hurt for them. So I was able to, like, do quite well as far as funding and getting support for them. And, you know, I just got to keep doing that. That's one of my biggest issues. If we don't have that voice down there, and you guys, I think, understand how it works at the Capitol, it really is a partisan place, and the majority party wins, and they make all the decisions. And so especially in budgeting, I just want to have that voice, and the budgets are still in play, even after I would get elected. So that'll be the number one priority, just make sure that Cedar Falls, Waterloo, Hudson is represented well.
When you were in the Iowa House, you were among the lawmakers who passed the largest tax cut in Iowa history in 2018.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's pretty adequate for the foreseeable future, or do you plan to expand upon that?
Well, I know there's discussions right now of property tax, you know, residential property tax reform. I haven't, you know, actually seen that legislation yet. I think it was a good thing that we did, you know, the property tax reform we did over the past couple of years, and even going back to the residential commercial that we did earlier on in my tenure there. And I think it just goes to a belief that dollars kept in the hands of job creators and entrepreneurs and business people is just a better use of dollars than if it goes to, you know, a big bureaucratic government. So that's just, you know, a philosophical difference, I think, between me and my opponent. And I think those dollars are more efficiently spent if people can use them for creating jobs and investing back in their community and in their businesses. And I'd like to see more of that. So, yeah, I like what we did. Obviously, we want to keep watch on it, make sure it is helping our economy. And right now, our economy in Iowa is doing pretty well.
Walt Rogers of Waterloo, a former member of the Iowa House representing District 60 from 2011 to 2019. He is the Republican running in the open Iowa Senate seat election, which takes place next Tuesday. That's for District 30. Walt, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Emily. Have a good day.
You're listening to a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury. We've been hearing from the Republican candidate for the vacant Senate seat for District 30. Now let's hear from his opponent. Democrat Eric Giddens of Cedar Falls is a program manager for the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's a member of the Cedar Falls Board of Education, and he joins me now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Emily.
What makes you feel uniquely qualified to represent District 30 in the Iowa Senate?
Well, I'll talk briefly about my education credentials. I grew up in an education family. I taught myself for a few years in the Cedar Falls School District. I work at the University of Northern Iowa as a program manager at the Center for Energy and Environmental Education, as you mentioned, and I'm now on the school board. You also mentioned that in Cedar Falls. I'm concerned about the path that I've seen in recent years from the state level with regards to funding and supporting our public education system from pre-K all the way up through our region's universities. So that's kind of the primary reason I'm interested in doing this. I want to represent public education. I'm also deeply concerned about the environment, but very concerned about the inaction I've seen at the state legislative level for environmental issues, water quality, climate action, those things. I'm here to be a voice for the Cedar Valley and in the state legislature, and to represent all of the constituents in Senate District 30, regardless of party, to bring solutions that are gonna address these issues that we need to be addressing right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, of those two top priorities that you just mentioned, let's tackle education first. Could you expand a little bit more on your concern for what you've seen in education over the last few sessions, and specifically what you would like to work on if elected into office?
Sure. So I'll mention three things. The first one I'd say is pre-K through 12 funding has been at a level that's not adequate for our public school districts. So what happens then, if we receive, as a member of the school board, I see this, behind the scenes with our school district and the work that I do with them. If we receive inadequate funds, we're not able to hire new teachers. What that ultimately results in is underpaying teachers, class sizes eventually needing to go up, those kinds of things. And the reality is that the increases we have seen, the modest increases we've seen in funding over the last several years, have not been able to even keep pace with inflation, particularly with the rising costs of health care that we have to provide to our employees. So that's a major concern, is K-12, pre-K through 12 funding levels. Another thing I've seen pushed in the legislature by the leadership in the legislature, and particularly actually by my opponent when he was House Education Chair for the last 2 years that he was in the Iowa House, was a move to push school vouchers. And that's a system that takes dollars that would go to our public school districts and shifts them to families for them to use for private education or homeschooling. So we have serious concerns, kind of first and foremost about a lack of oversight with those systems. And then I would say the third issue is inadequate funding for the University of Northern Iowa. That institution is right here in Senate District 30. We have a unique mission of educating Iowa students. So, 80% or so of our students at UNI come from small communities, not necessarily small, but from communities in Iowa. And after they graduate, tend to for the most part, return to Iowa communities. So we educate Iowans, and it the funding levels that we've seen over the last years have been inadequate, and the trajectory that we're on with that level of funding will need to eventually cause us to increase tuition. There won't be any way around it, and that makes it, you know, unsustainable in terms of being able to fulfill our mission of providing affordable education to Iowans. So that's another deep concern I have in the area of education.
So, and Eric, before I let you go, we have a lot of 2020 presidential candidates coming to the state of Iowa recently, and you've been interacting with some of them. How has that felt? What has that experience been like?
Well, it's been exciting. You know, these candidates are in our state anyway. This is an active caucus season. We're used to that here in Iowa. So, you know, this campaign for Senate District 30 is just a great opportunity for us to invite these candidates to see our community. You know, we don't know which one of them might end up being president of the United States. It's wonderful for us to have an opportunity like this to, you know, to invite these candidates and learn about the Cedar Valley, about Waterloo, Cedar Falls, Hudson, learn about the issues that we face, and then see what, you know, what the outcome of the caucuses is and this next election, and wish all of them the best in that process. So it's been a lot of fun.
And specifically, just to note, the people who have been, you've been interacting with, California Representative Eric Swalwell called to congratulate you when you won the nomination. California Senator Kamala Harris did the same the next day. And Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren helped you launch your campaign earlier this month. We've been talking about the open Senate seat for District 30 in the Iowa legislature. I've been talking with Democrat Eric Giddens of Cedar Falls. The election for this seat is taking place next Tuesday. Eric, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Emily.
And I'll mention that Libertarian candidate Fred Perryman of Cedar Falls will also be on the ballot on Tuesday. We're in the midst of an incredibly wet late winter, early spring, and portions of western Iowa have experienced some of the worst flooding that we've seen this week. Governor Kim Reynolds signed an emergency disaster proclamation, and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources says it's closed all or parts of its 9 state parks due to rising flood water. Joining me now from Sioux City is Iowa Public Radio's Western Iowa reporter, Katie Pikus. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Emily.
So you reported on a few towns being evacuated due to flooding this week, Missouri Valley and Hornick. What have you been hearing from folks? What's the extent of the damage?
Yeah, so in Missouri Valley in Harrison County, some levees were breached and flooding got worse. That was on a Thursday. Today, as of 2 hours ago, the evacuation was lifted for part of the town, and the mayor told me that almost everyone can go home except for close to 200 people whose homes are where there might still be a little bit of water that has not receded yet. And in Hornick, in Woodbury County, the mayor ordered the town's roughly 200 residents to evacuate because of a levee that broke and water that started to go into town. And they are meeting about that tonight with residents in the city. They're meeting in a city kind of close by, and the DNR is going to be there, and MidAmerican Energy is going to be there, and some other officials to talk more about all that.
And how are things looking for this weekend? Are these areas going to experience any relief?
We're not so sure. It could get a little bit better in Missouri Valley, as I said before, with the fact that a lot of people have been told they could go home. But we still don't know about this one little area with close to 200 people who still cannot go back home. We might see a little bit of flooding along Sioux City, even with the riverfront and levels in the Missouri River rising. So it could get a little bit worse for some businesses along the riverfront in Sioux City that have avoided flooding throughout the week. So we'll see about that.
Reporting from Western Iowa, Iowa Public Radio's reporter Katie Pikus. You can follow her reporting on our website, iowapublicradio.org, and on Twitter, at Katie Pikus. That's Pikus spelled P-E-I-K-E-S. Katie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Emily.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst proposed new parental leave legislation this week called the CRADLE Act. This would let parents take paid time off to care for their newborn children by delaying retirement and drawing from Social Security funds, their Social Security funds. This proposal comes a month after presidential candidate Senator Kirsten Gillibrand reintroduced the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act that would create a national program to provide up to 12 weeks of partially paid time off for workers. Workers would be able to earn up to 66% of their wages, up to a capped amount, and it would be funded by a small payroll tax paid by employers and employees. Here with me to discuss these plans is Deborah Wydus. She's a professor of law at Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and she's originally from Iowa City. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Emily.
So it seems like the major difference between these two plans is how time off would be funded. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So as you said in your introduction, the plan proposed by Senator Ernst would require workers to borrow against their own future Social Security savings. So it's sort of paying for family leave but jeopardizing your retirement security. Whereas the Family Act would be a really small payroll tax paid for by both employees and employers, but kind of spread across the whole taxpaying public.
Mm-hmm. What are some other kind of major similarities and differences you see between these two plans?
Well, the other really major difference is the range of needs that you could take paid leave for. So the CRADLE Act is really just about parental leave. That is when you have a new baby. And that's really important. And the U.S. is the only country in the world, or one of very few countries in the world, that doesn't guarantee paid leave, at least to new mothers. But the Family Act would cover a broader range of needs. So it would be paid leave when you have a new baby, but also if you can't work for a little while because of your own serious health condition, or if you need to care for a family member who has a serious health condition, or for certain needs related to service in the military by family members.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, with specifically pregnancy and pregnancy recovery, it seems that, you know, women would be more likely to use a family leave benefit. How do you see that disparity as it kind of relates to these two plans?
Well, it is true that women do tend to take more family leave. And the one of the things that's nice about the policies in the United States, as compared to some other countries, is that dads have equal rights to take time. And we actually see in some of the states that have put similar laws in place, a really high percentage of men claiming, which is good for equality in general. But you're right, women do tend to take more of this time and tend to take longer leave. And so what that would mean is that if it's paid for by their own Social Security savings, like the CRADLE Act does, really it's disadvantaging women when it comes to retirement, who already tend to have lower Social Security savings because of the gender wage gap, because of time that they may take out of the workforce with kids. So in general, already women have lower Social Security savings, and this would make that problem even worse. The Family Act wouldn't have that effect because everybody would be paying the same small tax and it's not sort of borrowing against your own savings.
Mm-hmm. Versions of both these proposals have come up before. Is there anything we can learn from the first time these were introduced?
Well, one thing I think it's really important just to say, it's exciting to see Republican proposals on this issue. I think that there's some problems with the way the CRADLE Act would be funded, but it's a major step forward to have Republican leaders agreeing that we really do need to have paid family leave in this country. As I said, the U.S. is unlike any other developed country in the world in that we don't guarantee this as a basic right of workers. So it is promising to have leaders from both parties talking about this as a real need, and voters across the spectrum support the idea of paid family leave. So I'm hopeful that there might be space to really work for a constructive solution on this issue.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Deborah Wydus is a professor of law at Indiana University, and she's originally from Iowa City. We love talking with Iowa natives. Deborah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Emily. It's great to get to be on Iowa Radio.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of the show is available at iowapublicradio.org and on podcasting services. Our theme music is by the River Monks. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about the show. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. ¶¶